It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and online at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
one of the factors the court looks to is how well are parents able to cooperate to resolve issues concerning their children. That's a very important factor. In addition to that, how well are parents able to assess what the needs are for their children? And certainly just treating your children rudely would be evidence of somebody's lack of ability to understand from a child's point of view how they might be looking forward to a visitation.
Family law attorney Sandra Bowen talks about how judges decide child custody cases and the 10 specific factors listed in the Code of Virginia, which are to be considered in determining child custody. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how payday lenders prey upon the poor and how the courts don't help. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 238, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Even though North Carolina made payday lending illegal in 2001, five lenders got around the law by affiliating with out-of-state banks to offer short-term, high-interest loans. One borrower contacted Carlene McNulty, a consumer rights lawyer at the North Carolina Justice Center. McNulty wanted to sue on behalf of tens of thousands of payday loan victims, but the fine print on the loan agreements barred recipients from class action lawsuits. By forcing every dispute into individual arbitration, companies can avoid lawsuits in areas like misleading credit card offers or sex discrimination. It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card for the company, McNulty says. Few poor or middle-class customers can arbitrate a dispute. The awards are generally capped, and the amounts are too low to make it worth a lawyer's time or fee. But class action lawsuits can be a powerful tool for reform. And so, suing the payday lenders under the state's unfair trade practice and usury laws, McNulty filed five class action cases, one against each of five major lenders still offering payday loans in North Carolina. The state courts allowed the cases to go forward, ruling that consumers weren't aware they were signing away their rights and there weren't enough lawyers willing to take individual cases to arbitration. By early 2011, three lenders settled for $37.5 million. The North Carolina Attorney General shut down the remaining payday lenders. Getting rid of predatory lenders was a victory for the citizens of North Carolina, but the larger question of the right of companies to limit consumers' ability to sue for bad practices has not been rectified. In 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a case similar to McNulty's class action lawsuit, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion. In that case, the consumers had signed a standard AT&T cell phone contract which, in the fine print, forced dissatisfied customers into individual arbitration. As in North Carolina, a lower court ruled that AT&T's bar on class action lawsuits was unjust under California law. But Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for a 5-4 majority, cited a 1925 federal law, the Federal Arbitration Act, and reversed the decision. The text of the law was clear, Scalia said. It was, quote, designed to promote arbitration, and states couldn't get in the way. But this was in no way consistent with what Congress was doing in 1925. Back then, arbitration was negotiated between merchants, not imposed by merchants on their customers and employees. Nevertheless, at least 139 class action lawsuits have been thrown out by the courts, including McNulty's. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. The Code of Virginia lists 10 specific factors to be considered in determining child custody, but which are the more important and which are less important? Family law attorney Sandra Bowen talks about how judges decide child custody cases in the first part of a two-part interview. We're here in the Far West End near Broad and Gaskins, and we are talking with Sandra Bowen, a member of Bowen, Ten, and Cardani. They have been in business out here since early February of 2014, and we will be talking with her today about how courts decide what's in the best interests of children in custody and visitation cases. Welcome back to the show, Sandra.
Well, thank you very much, Marty. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Now, the first thing I wanted to ask you is, even before we get into the courtroom, there's a lot of preparation that people have to do, especially if they are representing themselves in custody and visitation cases, which often happens. What are your suggestions to people on how to prepare to represent themselves?
In fact, most of the cases that are heard in the juvenile courts in the Richmond metropolitan area, folks are there without lawyers. So the vast majority of cases are self-represented parties. I think the most helpful information somebody can have in preparing to go to court on a custody or visitation case falls into a couple of preliminary categories here, but certainly figure out how you're going to get to the courthouse, know where it is. And I always tell folks, plan to be there 30 minutes early. If your summons says that your case is at 11, plan to be there at 10:30. If the case says 9, plan to be there at 8:30. In a lot of our courthouses, parking is very challenging, especially if you're going to any of the downtown courts. But even in Henrico and Chesterfield, you have to walk quite a distance to get into the courthouse door. And once you get there, you're greeted by security. You'll go through metal detectors, and if you're carrying something that has to be returned back to the car, you're going to have to come back to the door and go through the line again. So it's best to allow yourself plenty of time to get there. You should know that cell phones are not allowed in almost all of the courts, so make sure you leave your cell phone in the car. One of the other things that I think throws people off is the dress code. Our courthouses all have dress codes, and these dress codes are posted at the door of the courthouse, but also they're enforced by the sheriff deputies that are running the security system at the door. So it's subject to their interpretation. Almost every courthouse prohibits flip-flops, shorts, real casual wear like tank tops, but the interpretation of what is a tank top can vary from courthouse to courthouse. I've seen people having to go back out to the car to grab some kind of a warm-up jacket from their kids' Little League team because they're wearing a nice stylish dress that just doesn't happen to have sleeves off the shoulder, just a regular dress with no sleeves, and they've been sent out to cover up. In one of our local courthouses, in fact, they were handing out white paper gowns like you might wear in a doctor's office for an examination, and people were wandering around in the halls wearing these long white paper gowns, and certainly they were singled out as the folks that had dressed wrong. You don't want to be one of those people in the white paper gown walking around in the courthouse. I've heard judges say to folks, You know, you don't have to go out and buy a new wardrobe to come to court. Just wear the best that you have. And if it turns out the only thing you have are shorts or the only thing you have are flip-flops, see if you can't borrow something from somebody else. At least you're comfortable and you're dressed correctly when you walk in the door and you get ready to present your case. So those are two bits of practical advice I give folks about just getting to the courthouse and getting there on time. But in addition to that, as you're planning what you're going to say, and this is advice I used to give out on the hotline to callers all the time, plan the five most important things about your case that you want the judge to know. If you're organized and you've written this down, even on like a 3x5 card, the judges are very encouraged and willing to listen when you say, I've got five important things I want you to know about my case. They're willing to patiently listen to you as opposed to somebody who starts kind of rambling all over, going back to day one in the birth of their child and pulling a big history out for the judge to hear. You just lose their interest, frankly.
So can you give our listeners some examples of what would be some of those five most important things that somebody in a custody or visitation case might want to even write down on a 3x5 card and make sure they tell the judge?
Oh, sure. And these tie into a code section that you can pretty much find on the internet. If you type into a Google search box or any search engine box, section 20-124.3 of the Virginia Code. That's section 20-124.3 of the Virginia Code. You're going to get the outline that's been given to the courts by the legislature of factors the court has to look at and consider evidence under in making this decision. A lot of cases come into court, and I'll just use this as an example. People with existing court orders that provide for visitation and have a schedule set out in the order may be dealing with another parent who is chronically late or, in fact, a no-show. Well, that would be an appropriate type of case to take into a judge to be able to say, look, my kids are having to sit here and wait hours for a parent who doesn't show up. Well, if you've got a fact situation like that, think in terms of what kind of solution do you want the judge to give you? They don't have a magic bag full of solutions that they can draw out and say, oh, here's the perfect one for you. They're counting on you to come in and say to them, here's how to solve this problem. Five most important factors in a situation like that would certainly include efforts that you've made to address this problem with the other parent. Because one of the factors the court looks to is, how well are parents able to cooperate to resolve issues concerning their children? That's a very important factor. In addition to that, how well are parents able to assess what the needs are for their children? And certainly just treating your children rudely would be evidence of somebody's lack of ability to understand from a child's point of view how they might be looking forward to a visitation.
So when you try to draft a solution to the problem to present to the judge and say, hey, this is what I would like Your Honor to do, there's always this tension between proposing something that is incredibly much in your favor and against the other side, as opposed to something that's not enough in your favor and maybe gives the other side too much. How do you draw that balance?
Well, first of all, I think that most parents, if they think in terms of what's best for their children, aren't going to have any trouble coming up with some sort of proposed solution that's actually fair, because what the court really cares about is what's best and fair for the children, not so much what's best, fair, and convenient for the parents. So if you start from that orientation, the kind of situation I've just used as an example might involve meeting at a neutral location, like a parking lot at a gas station or the famous Burger King at 6 o'clock exchange that we see in so many court orders. In a situation like that, you might say to the judge, make him come to my house to pick up the children. because that way the kids can watch TV or they can hang out and play or they can have their toys or at least I can feed them something while they're waiting. And it's not quite as hard on the children as waiting in the back seat of a car someplace. I think a judge would look at a solution like that very favorably. Requirements that might say, if the other parent's going to miss their visitation, they need to let me know. Or if they're going to exercise the visitation, they need to let me know. Those are the kind of solutions that resonate with the judges to solve the problem that I've just used as an illustration.
You said that parents need to view this as not what's best for mom, not what's best for dad, but what's best for the child. And that's what the judge is supposed to do, what's in the best interest of the child. So how does the judge decide what's in the best interests of the child?
Well, that's where the story that you tell, these five most important points, has to tie into what we call the statutory factors. If you have a situation where you've got kids who are struggling in school with homework and maybe a midweek visitation for dinner is too disruptive, then your five points might center around report cards, need for special help at school, difficulty managing deadlines, and then you also want to tie in some of the efforts that you've made to work this out with the other parent, sending homework to be done during a midweek visitation. And a story like that hits several of these statutory factors, and it's very helpful to the judge to know those things, because really what the court's looking for are facts. They're not so concerned about what you think about things as they are about the facts. Anytime you can help the judge make a good decision about your child, the judges welcome that assistance. The courts have to make decisions based on your family specifically. And I find that most of the judges in our particular area here, Chesterfield, Henrico, the city of Richmond, Hanover, Powhatan, Dinwiddie, Petersburg, just the greater ring of metropolitan Richmond, and I've practiced in all those courts over the last 30 years, all of those judges want to do a good job, and they want to do what's best for your child, and they take everybody's case very seriously when you walk in the door. So you want to let the judge know a little bit about your child. One of the five most important things you should tell the judge is introduce them to the child. Tell them your kid's name and age, where they are in school, what their favorite activities are, who their best friend is, how they best enjoy spending time. Or maybe there's something about your child that they're struggling to overcome. Maybe they've been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Maybe they've got bad asthma, things like that. You want the judge to know a bit about who your child is. That's going to help them as they try to help you formulate a solution to the problem.
So of the 10 factors that the General Assembly has given the judges to look at, and it says that the court shall consider the following, are there any that really stand out in your mind as ones that are really super important for the judge, or is this just so case-by-case basis you really can't make that determination? You really can't pull out specific factors that are more important than others.
I think that there are three that really do jump out as the most important considerations for the court. One is the role that the parents play and will play in the future regarding the care and upbringing of the child. It's relevant for the judge to know, and that's a word we use in court, relevant. It has meaning to the task at hand. It's relevant for the court to know what role you've played with regard to the care and raising of your children, and what role the other parent has played. There are a lot of families where child rearing is pretty much left up to one parent. There are also a lot of situations where there's a parent who insists on taking over all of the child rearing responsibilities. So in a situation where you've got an extreme like that, the court needs to know how that came to be. Is it because the other parent doesn't share those responsibilities nicely and graciously? Or is it because somebody just has to do it all themselves because they think everybody else is not competent? But that's something the court wants to know. And they also recognize that in real families, at least where parents are living together during part or all of their child's life, that there is some sharing of responsibilities in the household. And the court wants to know that. So you need to be fair when you're telling your story. Here are the things I did. Here are things the other parent did with regard to the child. I think the next thing that is very important and relevant is how well do each of the parents support the child's involvement with the other parent? That's identifying special time or special things that a parent and a child might do together. And again, pretty much every situation, there's some bonding link between a child and a parent, even if it's just minimal. I think a court would like to hear about that, and I think that has some bearing in a court's decision. Then again, I think the biggest bell ringer is going to be the ability of the parents to work together to resolve disputes. I think we're fortunate around here in that many of our judges have become well aware of the fact that there are some parents who can't get along no matter what. And I'm starting to see in some courts judges being persuaded away from joint legal custody, which is joint decision-making authority, into a sole custodial arrangement, even though the time shared is very generous and maybe even as much as 50-50, somebody's got to be the decision maker. And in some very difficult and unfortunate high conflict cases, our courts are willing to make that difficult call.
One of the factors that the court, again, shall consider is any history of family abuse.
Oh, yeah.
And how does that factor into child custody and child visitation cases?
Well, that is very important. And if any of the listeners have experienced family abuse or spousal abuse in any of their relationships, my heart goes out to them. It's an impossibly difficult situation to have to go through in a relationship. But that factor number 9, you know, that one's a little different than all the others. Courts, when they're looking at setting an initial order of custody, certainly would consider everything from almost the date the child was born until the day people are in court. But when you're before a judge trying to modify an existing court order, the judges follow the rule of law, which says that the evidence they're going to hear has to be after the date of the last court order. So they don't want to hear things that happened prior to the last court order, with the exception of the history of family abuse. That evidence lives on, and no matter how remote in time, the courts will still consider its relevance in the current proceeding. Family abuse facts, doesn't really matter who was involved in the abusive interaction, whether the child was a party to it or not. The fact is that it happens in the home where the child resides is enough to make it relevant to the court. It doesn't have to result in physical injury, medical attention, or hospitalization. It can be verbal abuse as well. But what this statute is referring to very specifically ties back into the kind of facts that are relevant and support criminal convictions with respect to family abuse and also protective orders. But this factor says any history of family abuse, whether it's been prosecuted or whether or not a protective order was sought, it is still relevant to the court's consideration. I've seen this come up in a fact pattern where one parent would let off steam simply by punching holes in the walls. No child should have to live in a home which is littered with walls that have holes in them. Children shouldn't have to see tangible evidence of an adult's temper like that. Kicked in doors, broken doors, things like that. I've seen those kind of factors seriously and persuasively influence a judge. They want to protect children from family abuse. They want to break the chain of abuse that's afflicted some families for generations. And at this point, I would also follow up with substance abuse and alcohol abuse. These are also factors that, although there is no particular category that makes that relevant, Factor 10, which is sort of a catch-all under this statute, says such other factors as the court deems necessary to make a fair determination. But very often, alcohol and substance abuse go hand in hand with domestic violence and family abuse. So I think that's a very important thing for the courts to know. Anybody testifying in a proceeding like this who might testify that they've observed the other parent using illegal substances, for example, should feel safe making that testimony in court. They're not going to be prosecuted because of what they say. They're not going to be subject to civil penalty for what they say. But if it's relevant and helpful for the court, courts should always know about a parent's habits with regard to substances, including alcohol.
You've been listening to family law attorney Sandra Bowen talking about how judges decide child custody cases in the first part of a two-part interview. The second part will continue next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The Code of Virginia lists 10 specific factors to be considered in determining child custody, but which are the more important and which are less important? Join us next week at 12:30 p.m. when family law attorney Sandra Bowen continues her talk about how judges decide child custody cases in the second part of a two-part interview. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbrink.